Interview with Caspers, MLD, 26th of
April 1967.
I'm interested in knowing whether your subject background, whether it's an art subject, has any bearing on attitude when you're working with it. Because
yeah.
Decisions make decisions, you know,
like
to
be too
art oriented, but I wonder
whether
it's
constant. I wouldn't say that. I think, particularly in administration, because accounts cost always seem to crop up. Almost any job that is involved would not only have an administrative, purely administrative. To it, but it also involves the question of cost, particularly job I did for it. Now, Food Commissioner, I was there for something like 9 years, more than 9 years. As Food Commissioner, I was 9 years there, 2 years earlier, that was about 11 years. It was always a question of cost.
So you see that a science background or economics background has
definitely.
What about in the field, as a district officer?
District officer, I'm afraid I wasn't very much in the field. As GA, I only spent 1 year, actually.
I was thinking of your early period as OA and as a cadet.
As OA and cadet, as cadet, there was a little training in the field. But that was during the British era. And the attitude toward the peasant was a little more different to what it is now.
How would you describe it?
In that case, it was more a fatherly sort of attitude, doing what you could for the peasant and helping him, but not really trying to, shall we say, let him do something on his own which would bring him up to a level where he could feel he could be independent.
Whereas today
I think that's entirely different. I mean, for one thing, he himself treats you as an equal. Well, in the old days, it was certainly not like that. We were more or less agents of the British. And they treated us as extensions of the Britishers who were holding power, positions of authority. Not that I say that respect has gone down, but they feel more equal terms.
Is this due to education or a general change in the atmosphere?
No, a general change in the atmosphere. They certainly don't feel that they are underdogs as such. I mean, they be underdogs economically, but not underdogs in attitude or by concepts or anything like that.
Isn't this due to the political process?
Yes, entirely due to the political process.
And if I may ask a somewhat personal question, when you got into the civil service, did you consider it just a job, or did you look on it as a kind of mission?
No, I would say that I, and I think many others, almost all I would say, regarded it as the best possible job they could get. In those days, the other jobs were very few. I mean, the jobs which we would have liked to have got were very, very few. Mercantile sector was practically open only to relations of Britishers and so on.
Is there what about the Britain team, sir, senior officers? Was it also just a job for them, or had some sense of
it? I think originally it would have been a job for them. But many of them did develop a sense of wanting to do a little more than merely what they have to do to earn their living and their pay.
Now, for instance, in your case, once you got into the job, did you find it inspiring you in a particular way?
not come in the first 2 years certainly. And by the time 2 years had passed, we had more or less got independence, or on, well on the road to it. And then attitudes changed in any case.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering what prevailed more, whether idealism or cynicism?
Very difficult to say which would have been more.
Was there something
more? Naturally, I am a little cynical, more cynical than otherwise. On a personal basis.
Taking the sort of the British tradition and as epitomized by the senior British officer, what would you say were the essence, the good qualities?
Well, the British civil servant, for one thing, in fact, even like his civilian counterpart, was shifted around so much, or so regularly, that he really did not have roots in any particular department or any particular office. And that gave him a chance of developing a sense of fairness towards the people who came to him for various needs and towards his subordinates. I found that it is quite true that the man who gets promoted from the rank, however nice they might, that might appear in practice, in theory, actually, in practice, he has developed so much of roots, so much of antagonism towards others in the same department, that very often, unless he is recognized, very rarely found, there is a tendency to vent some of his previous displeasure.
A kind of chip on the shoulder.
Yes. I found that quite come and right through the department I've been. Come in. And quite a lot of them who had tried both systems, that is say the civil servant who came in there for 2 or 3 years and then went away, far preferred that to the man who was permanently there.
But in some instances, weren't transfers all too frequent?
Might have been made a little less frequently, but still I found it hard to grumble at it. For instance, I had almost one transfer every year.
Would the term impersonal guardianship describe the attitude of the officers in the late 30s and early 40s?
Yes, I think you could say that.
How far did it continue into the 50s and 60s?
I think despite what the general feeling or the newspaper feeling would like to have imagined, the officers did feel that they were no longer tools of somebody else to carry out somebody else's work. And that if they were going to continue to do a job, that job had to be done more in their national interest.
In a sense, then, after 48, you had a keener sense of participation.
I would say so. Mm-hmm.
In British times, would you say that there was a kind of elitist concept going with this attitude of impersonal guardianship?
No, I don't think that there was much difference there, even after 48. The feeling of eliteness continued. That was simply inherent from the job itself. And not so much a feeling of superiority, but a feeling that they were doing the top jobs. They had been trained for those jobs. And purely by reason of training, they were in a position to do those jobs better than somebody who had not been trained for that.
And the very nature of the job, deciding between issues and having...
They were always in a position to judge, you see, they were always put into a position. In fact, even in the much older days, when civil servants were magistrates and judges, even if they were a bit short on the law, they were certainly extremely long on the sense of justice and fair play. And I have often come across lawyers who regretted the passing of the old days, where they were able to get pretty good summary justice dealt out.
Do you think the legal type of judge tends to be too legal-minded and apply less common sense in a way?
I think that is possible. Most of the civil servant judges who certainly were not, as I said, very legal-minded, were more interested in
equity.
Yes, in equity. And dealt with their cases on that basis, and I think that was probably more acceptable.
But one wonders if the whole British legal system doesn't tend to emphasize law to the detriment of justice.
Of possible. But the British civil servants themselves certainly went on the principle of equity.
How about their fairness when it came to the rare cases, when it came to a judgment between an European and a foreigner?
I think there was bias. I used to imagine there was not, but I am inclined to think there was a bias.
In judicial cases?
No, I won't say in judicial cases, certainly in administrative cases.
Administrative cases. Unconscious or?
Conscious but very carefully veiled, mm-hmm. So as not to be very obtrusive. They certainly did not blatantly display it.
What about the extent to which they represented the needs of the villagers? In the late 30s, was an average to good AGA able to represent the needs of the area better than the politician, the average politician?
Much better.
Much better.
Any AGA who was doing a decent job knew his villagers more than the politician did those days.
People like DSN Nayakam?
They may have been special cases. I mean, you had to be one with the people, and the GS were certainly expected to do that.
But hasn't it been a feature of modern times that with the jeep and the car, the AG of today lives out much less, and therefore perhaps knows the people less?
That's possible. In those days, they used to stay out a lot in circuit bungalows and poor court. Very often the GA was also the magistrate. And people used to come to him not only with their legal troubles, but their other troubles as well. They had nobody else to go to, in fact. Mm-hmm.
What about the headman?
They went to the headman first. Mm-hmm. They did go to the headman. And if not to the headman, they certainly went to the chief headman. But if both those failed, they certainly took the opportunity of the GAs coming on circuit to go and meet the GAs.
What are your views on the headman system as prevailing then?
Not at all a bad system. It perpetuates a certain amount of feudalism and very connotation of these terms used. A sort of different level between the officials and the peasants. But apart from that, it was a good system because they had somebody they could go to.
But what about
it all depended on the men who were doing the job.
What about family cliquism and perhaps minor acts of oppression?
Quite possible.
happened. What about the relationship between the headman and the district officer? Were they servile and obeisant?
Very. The feeling of position ran right down the line.
Feeling of?
Position. Difference in position ran right down the
status.
Line.
Status. There is a kind
Everyone
of
was very conscious of the difference in status and acted accordingly.
Yes, but the point is there is a kind of servility and flattery which gets its own way. I was wondering whether they could influence the AGA.
Might have been, but the sense of respect in those days was very, very high. Possibly as a means of flattery for permanent advancement or something like that, but anyway, it was there.
To what extent did an average AGA rely on the A, the RM, and B, the lower level?
Depended on his own personality. If he was the type who was lazy, he would depend more. If you are the type who like to know whether something was actually happening and reported, he depended less and thought more to find out for himself by going out on inspection.
Couldn't the Kachari Mudaliya have a pronounced influence on the AGAs and GAs?
Could.
In fact, on what basis were the Mudaliyas and Hedman appointed?
Mostly on family basis.
Did
in the old days, on family basis.
Did that mean that they were largely Goigamas in the Sinhalese area?
It all depended on the area involved, I think, and on the people in a position to influence the GAs. The GAs decided entirely.
I presume the GAs had a lot of authority. Would it be correct to say that they were, to a fair degree, a law unto themselves?
Some of the GAs are very autocratic. But I think on the whole, the authority they had, which was immense, was not misused.
Mm-hmm. Were they willing to go against orders from Colombo if they considered it in the best interest of everyone?
Of whom is the point? Best interest of, question would arise, best interest of whom? Would it be in the best interest of their own clan, as the Britishers, or in the best interest of the country around them?
I presume both sides cropped up. Say, it was in the best interest of the country around here?
That also would depend on the circumstances. Mm-hmm. Those days the GS had a lot of respect for the planters, who they felt were the backbone of the country.
Presumably the more the stronger and stronger GS with some personality were willing to disobey orders,
I would say they felt strong enough to disobey if they felt they could do it, if they wanted to do it. The only thing is that Colombo always had an answer to it. They merely transferred him and got somebody else to do the job.
Mm-hmm. Now, it is noticeable that their responsibility is to Colombo. Hasn't all this changed both ways? Their wings have been clipped by the 50s to some extent. And they are more and more responsive to public opinion, local public opinion.
Yes, that is true. For one thing, I don't know whether the youngsters follow that, but certainly we are brought up to feel that, particularly after independence, that people's needs had to be satisfied, and as far as possible, we should do what was reasonable to help them to satisfy those needs.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that after independence, and especially after 56, there has been a closer identification
with the public.
There is a general trend like that. The thing is that The thing is that there are always two types of people, always will be.
Studios and independent?
No, not quite like that. That's quite another category entirely. But a category like those who would look for, I would say the more lackadaisical type, I won't say entirely lazy, those who would look for a means of seeing how something can be prevented from being done, and others who look for a method of doing it. That is, I would say, the main difference. The only
negative
difference.
And positive.
Those who want to do a job will find a means of doing it. Those who are what you would call slackers would like to find a means of not doing it, or a means of postponing it, or a means of putting it off, or a means of dropping it, or a means of objecting to it.
And there has been a criticism raised of the civil service in British times and even afterwards that they were sometimes disdainful of the public. But quite often it has been raised by MPs, which meant that they were the civil servants were disdainful of the
MP.
How fair is that?
Oh, there may have been cases on both sides, but I think on the whole it would be unjustified.
Presumably a problem that arose in your case, especially when you were out in the district, would have been that your background was urban and western. Did that make adaptation difficult?
No, in those days everyone's background was urban and western.
Yes. No, I was thinking of the villager and my question of the rapport with the villager.
No, I would say that would depend on the attitude of the person involved. If the attitude was that of somebody who would like to do a decent, fair job. But there was the overriding requirement the overriding feeling that they were there to look after the peasant at that stage.
Yes, but now in the case of the Britain especially, wouldn't there have been a language problem? In many cases. I mean, their knowledge of Sinhalese or Tamil wouldn't have been very broad.
No, most of the civil servants' knowledge of Sinhalese was quite good.
Oh, that's very interesting. No, you see, I was also thinking of it in my terms. If I went today as an AGA, I'm wondering how I would fit myself into...
Yeah, in the old days he had to pass two exams in Sinhalese and at least one in Tamil. And the exam level was quite high, certainly on the colloquial side.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that today, because of the political process and the fact that civil service is less exclusive and has made it also less impartial, far more involved politically and sometimes so identified with the people that the paternalism has gone?
Well, actually, that may possibly be true, but you always come across certain specimens who refuse to give up their impartiality. These fall broadly into two categories, which I have found, and that is those who would be impartial whatever happened. And others who, while liking to be impartial, were able to be impartial because they wouldn't have cared if they were thrown out of their job the following day, being possessed of adequate independent means.
So a lot depends also on the home circumstances and the...
Yes.
When I mentioned the word stooges last time, you did answer in the affirmative, and would you say that that has tended to grow because of the political process?
I think that has tended to grow, particularly with the changes in political colorings of those in power.
Did 56 bring a big change? It is argued that way, but...
Not as big as people like to make out. Most people found it quite easy to continue doing their job in a fair and reasonable manner. Mm-hmm. Whatever others may have thought about it, certainly did not run after them. Shall we say the new master. But that did not mean that their job was performed any the less better.
Weren't ministers a bit more prone to interfere, and wasn't friction more pronounced?
In 56?
After 56.
After 56, I think general tendency was a bit more blatant in interfering. There was generally a fair amount of interference.
Even before?
Yes, even before, but the actual difference I found was in the blatancy. Now I can remember some cases in that era where court cases, for instance, a man would rush to court holding up a paper in his hand, giving to the magistrate, "I don't care what you do to me, I've already got a pardon." Now that sort of thing may have happened even before 56 and may even be happening now, but it wasn't so blatantly done.
What about the position of the permanent secretary after independence? Didn't the ministers want permanent secretaries who were amenable to their views?
Yeah, most of them would, but it all depends on the permanent secretary. I know quite a few who just were not amenable to that. Part of that independence, as I am aware, came from their ability to maintain an independent existence apart from their job.
Was it general for most ministers to rely on the permanent secretary, to rely largely on the permanent secretary and not interfere?
I think there is a tendency to do that, particularly ministers who were not sufficiently au fait with what they were supposed to do.
In fact, haven't it been a noticeable feature of our political development that many of the ministers are not too okay with their subjects and don't go into the fires very easily?
That is probably true. They find it easier to speak to their permanent secretaries and then give a decision when all the details are pointed out, verbally.
I presume that in many cases the position of the permanent secretary was quite difficult in that he was so much better equipped intellectually than the minister concerned. I am not really capable intellectually, perhaps in personality too. I mean, there would have been some ministers who were not all that capable, who still had the power to enforce their opinions. But in other cases, this gap would have made relations rather embarrassing.
Well, it depended on the minister, I would say. Very often the minister who did not know as much as another of his colleagues would take the permanent secretary into his confidence and act more on his advice, except of course when it came to a question of policy which may have had a political bearing, on which he knew that he would just couldn't do what the official mind would have liked. And that the political decision was the superior one from his point of view.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I may ask some personal question, did you have many difficulties with your minister?
Not really. When I found how the wind was blowing in a particular case, I generally found a way of getting out of the difficulty of having to put forward something which the minister might have found difficulty in accepting. There are methods. Really, except on the absolutely political decisions, most of the ministers were keen on getting jobs done. And once they were satisfied that a person was willing to do a job, they did not press him too far on something that could not be
implemented politically.
Yes.
Now I was wondering whether because of the intellectual gap, while some ministers relied on the permanent secretary, others had an inferiority complex which made them rather aggressive.
That is possible. But I think that they would have been in a minority, really. Because, except for those who really thought they were far superior intellectually to the permanent secretaries, the majority of the parents were prepared to accept that the permanent secretary, if not by any other, for any other reason, by virtue of his experience, generally knew what he was talking about on his ministry.
But didn't D.S. Sennayaka in particular begin a practice of interfering with the appointment of permanent secretaries and departmental heads, and have men of his own choice?
That is done, that has been done by all prime ministers.
And in fact, is the Public Service Commission the independent body it was meant to be?
I don't know about the present one, but I must certainly say I think it was not so in the past. I don't know at all about it, I mean, I just haven't heard.
No, in your time.
But I think in our time it was strongly suggested that they were in the Public Service Commission, was in the habit of getting direction from the Prime Minister on the appointments to be made.
And what about Mrs. B's time?
Get a drink.
You
want to take the car?
Yeah, I thought was.
And beer at
all? Yeah, I prefer soft drink. I don't care for beer.
Then something strong?
No, I don't have soft drink. How far was Mrs. Bandaranaike Prime Minister at the start? I mean, given her inexperience, do you know if she had to rely a great deal on others?
I think that is generally correct. But after a couple of years, certainly, if not a shorter period, she certainly got a grasp of affairs and was had pretty well a mind of her own on many points, many matters.
But isn't it correct to say that she was in some ways stronger than Bandaranaike himself?
In some ways stronger, but based on less experience and knowledge, I think.
And more,
she was prepared to take more chances on her decisions being correct. Or shall we say on the result of her decisions being as she expected. You see, I'm talking generally of even something like a political decision. The political decision like we won't do this. Let politician X resign if he likes. Generally, her anticipation was correct in that he did, would not resign.
But it was a gamble.
I think she sometimes may have had a better appreciation of her strength than Bandaranaike.
Was Bandaranaike far too prone to temporize and to procrastinate?
Yes, I would say so. Anything to put off.
An administrative ability? Listening from ideas?
Does administrative ability come in at that stage, at that level?
It's not necessary, is it?
No.
Say for a minister, should a minister also have, if not a, merely a grasp of administrative affairs, at least some administrative ability?
No, I don't think so. The main thing he really needs is common sense, horse sense. And that certainly DSL. I mean, somebody could explain the problem to him and he would decide it entirely on a common sense basis. The most technical problem could be decided on such a manner.
Sir John?
Sir John, I think, went more on impulse.
Dudley?
A lot on common sense, but now I think changed more with political, the political flavor.
Political flavor. Didn't DS have the ability to choose the right men and also to inspire the whole civil service?
He did, up to a certain extent, especially those who came into contact with him. They were made to feel that he appreciated what they were doing.
Turn to your period as a censor. Was it the practice to have liaison with other departments, and if you found anything of anything private of value to some other department for you to send it on, say?
Oh, yes, quite.
And have you any idea how the mercantile and planting sector looked on Caldecott?
No, I don't tell you at all. We are certainly not in touch at that time, you see. Mercantile planting sector.
No, I was wondering whether the job as censor brought any information.
No, no, not that far as I can remember.
And jump into this period as deputy food controller and your position in the food department. After the war, did you, or in fact even during the war, did you have a rice subsidy of sorts? Wasn't there a guaranteed price scheme?
No, there was always a rice subsidy. Huh? It kept on increasing. It could be the records. The Food Commission has all reports to show how much was spent on subsidy.
A natural increase. But somewhere around 50s, didn't they take a step which meant that the subsidy doubled or...?
That was the time they increased the ration from. Yeah, something like a ration of one measure for an infant, 1 1/4 for a child, 1 1/2 for an ordinary, and 1 3/4 or 2 measures for a worker. So somewhere around there they increased the ration to 2 measures for each person. Irrespective of age.
Right. Have you any idea what
political?
To win votes, in other words. But wasn't there an economic crisis or some economic question which led them to do this?
No, if anything, the economic position was good.
Now, friend, I'm not clear on this, but I heard a garbled version, which I haven't been able to check through the records, saying that there was a cost of living allowance at that time, which was which are on a sliding scale because attached to the cost of living index, which they were keeping, and then something went up, coconut, and they suggested rationing or subsidizing coconuts, but this was not practicable administratively, and they decided to do it with rice.
I can't tell
you. I mean, did you come into the decision making on this at all?
Oh yes, at least I would have given advice on this. Whether the rice was available and the amount of subsidy that would be involved and so on. But the decision would have been based on those factors and on any political considerations that there were.
Would it be correct to say that the civil servants were against raising the subsidy?
No, I don't think they get it there.
And I'm also interested in your views on the general question of control, because we've had this problem recently. The regulations and attempting to control imports. And sometimes control breed more control and more difficult.
I think personally that the official would prefer less control than more control.
Is it worthwhile controlling things when it's so difficult to implement?
On the whole, there is no alternative. Take exchange control, for instance. If you didn't have exchange control, how are you going to reduce the drain on your foreign exchange? Are you going to allow everybody who wants to send foreign exchange, out, or to import anything he wants to do so?
But now it's a question of import quota. To the industrialists and the traders, sometimes they want this thing done with speed, but our administration doesn't seem geared to doing that.
Yeah, everything can be oil, not necessarily with palm oil. Can be done if required, if there is somebody who is willing enough to take the trouble. whether he benefits from it or not. Very often it's lack of staff.
But then of course that's a matter which we have to basically put right.
I noticed that you were acting permanent secretary to the Ministry of Agriculture and Food for a little while. That was under CP Chakraborty.
No, that would have been... That would have been... What was the year?
56.
That would have been Philip.
How did you find Philip as a minister?
Very sure of himself, knowing where he was going.
He knew where he was going.